God had to lead me through the wilderness and prune some of these things, peel back some of these layers to say, hey, I don't need you to focus on providing. I need you to put your eyes on the provider.
Everybody, Doc Brian here, and welcome to Doc Talks. We talk about people's troubles, trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs in life. Today, we're in LifeWord Studios in Conway, Arkansas. LifeWord is the media broadcast ministry of the Baptist Missionary Association of America. They produce content in over 150 languages in 123 countries and a potential listening audience of 2 billion people. You can find all of their Christian content on lifeword.org. Today with me, I have Tyler Stoner. He's a good friend of mine. I've known him for probably 3 or 4 years now. Just a great guy. And so, Tyler, it's good to have you with us today.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just excited to, you know, get into it, dive deep, and, you know, hopefully this will bless some people.
Sure. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up, what you do in life, your family.
Yeah, so we're professional rednecks. I grew up in a little farming community in northeast Arkansas. Basically, was born in Newport. It's in the Delta. Was raised in a place no one's ever heard of called Cord, outside of Batesville. And, man, that's it. Just had good parents. Dad was and still is a very hard worker. He worked. He traveled working on nuclear plants. Mom was a very traditional stay-at-home mom, and it was good. Obviously, you know, imperfect, as most families are. Had some chaos, had some things we went through as a family, but, you know, we came out on the other side of it, and that's it.
Yeah. Married, have a kid.
Yes, my family. Married to Lynette. We've been married 4 years now. Been together for quite a while. We've got an 8-year-old daughter. So if you guys want to do the math on that, there it is. but her name's Avery, and man, she's a perfect mix of Lynette and I both. She has my stubbornness and just craziness, but she's sweet like her mom. So and looks like her mom, thank goodness.
Yes, thank the Lord for that. So she's 8, my son is 8, and tell me about that moment where you realized your life was forever changed because now you have a baby girl to take care of.
Yeah, you know, everyone talks about, like, the moment, like, when she's born and you see her. I don't know that there was ever a moment. I think, if anything, the moment was when Lynette told me that she was pregnant. And, of course, she was distraught. And in that moment, you know, you've got to make a decision. Are you going to be calm and rational and strong, or are you going to be just as distraught? And I think in that moment, it was just like, okay, here we go. We're doing this. There is no other option. We're going to have a baby, and we're going to raise a baby. And regardless, you know, we were unmarried at the time, of course. And so, you know, the thought was like, hey, look, regardless of our mistakes and our youth and even our relationship, we're going to raise the baby. We're going to be good parents, and we're going to figure this thing out. So,
yeah. So Doc Talks, of course, is a mental health podcast from a Christian viewpoint. So tell me a little bit about your mental health, your struggles that you've dealt with in life.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I grew up with a dad that we jokingly say he thinks he is John Wayne. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were just from that era. Mental health was not a thing. You know, suck it up, throw some dirt on it kind of deal, which is good in certain ways. So just FYI, I've struggled with depression really noticeably since I was probably about 18 or 19. And certainly some, you know, ADD, ADHD. And I know those two sort of intermingle. So it's hard to say when one stopped and when one was the other. And, you know, what was ADHD versus being a young, hyper-curious boy? But I've definitely struggled with that. And those things have led to making choices that have certainly amplified some of it too.
Mm. Yeah, I know that within our age group, and there's you know, a lot of years between us.
Not that many.
Yeah. that, you know, as we were younger, if there was any type of hyperactivity, you were labeled ADD and you were given a pill. And thankfully today we've kind of gotten away from that. There's a Vanderbilt study that's filled out by the teacher, you know, whomever, and the parent, and then they compare those two to get a diagnosis. But in growing up, a lot of times when people thought we had ADD or ADHD, it resulted in some sort of trauma at home from our parents yelling at us to do this or that, or our teachers. And I'm sure you're old enough to remember when they spanked kids in school, you know, that it was this thought process that it was a behavior issue and not a mental health issue.
Yeah. So I still remember vividly, I want to say this was second grade, and it's just, there's several of these, but there's one that has, for whatever reason, like implanted in my brain. And like, you know me well enough to know, I jokingly say, I'm really smart. I'm just smart enough to be really stupid sometimes. Mm. But really, I was a bright, intelligent young kid, which I think served to frustrate my teachers when I didn't do good in school. But I remember this vivid time in second grade where I was doing a really simple, I think it was like two front and back, you know, worksheets as a second grader would. And it took me like 4 hours. And it was that, you all know, that super just dramatic at the table. Mom's like, you're not going to get up until you finish it, and just yelling. And she's getting frustrated because she doesn't know how to parent a child that way. And I'm getting frustrated because my brain wants to do anything but this. And I would say a lot of that. And I just think there was a lot of labeling, and really the school system tries to take a square peg and stick it in a round hole where they get boys that are, you know, naturally designed to be out and out doing things and learning things and working with their hands and getting dirty, and throw them in a classroom and say, sit down for 7 hours, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, we all have a different way of learning and processing. And I think school districts, education in general, have come a long way in their approach to how to handle that. My son has ADHD, but he's not the hyperactive type of ADHD. He's the, I'm going to stare out a window until somebody gets my attention kind of ADHD. So, you know, sticking a square peg in a round hole is a perfect example of that. Let's move forward a little bit to life now. We were going to talk a little bit about the stress or the intensity-induced depression, or how did you? What was the word that you used? Stress-induced
self-dependency-induced depression.
There you go.
Yeah.
Now that's not a term that's in the DSM, but I understand what you're talking about. So tell us a little bit about what that definition means to you.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I believe that anything good comes from the Lord, period, end of story. Whether that be just the ability to enjoy something, or whether that be true peace, happiness, and that could even be financial provision. So I grew up in a household that claimed Christianity, but didn't practice it in any way, shape, or form. I grew up really bad theology. The point of that being, I never had a good base for where things come from. We grew up pretty poor, and so I just had this insatiable appetite, not for success in the realm of like, I need the cars and the cool things, but just like, I want nice things. I want stability. I want my daughter to have all these things. And what that led to is let me figure it out. And let me take the risks, and let me read all the self-improvement books and listen to all the self-improvement podcasts and outwork everyone. And what that led to was a lot of destruction, because God had to lead me through the wilderness and prune some of these things, peel back some of these layers to say, hey, I don't need you to focus on providing. I need you to put your eyes on the provider. That's what happened.
Yeah, I think it's very easy for us to get off track. And, you know, while a mental health issue is a chemical issue, these things that we allow in our life, or these deficits, if you will, can lead us to a major mental health crisis. And the expectations that we set for ourselves. Now, there's nothing wrong with setting expectations, setting goals, but so many times we set those goals as to this is where I want to be in a year, and it's not realistic. That should be a 5-year goal.
Well, the root of the goal was the problem, right? So I grew up. I hesitate to use the word poor because, like, I didn't have a bad childhood. But it was the type of childhood where, like, we grew up, we didn't have a lot. We always had what we needed, but it was always feast or famine. I would dare say there was a lot of just poor money management. And so it wasn't like we were walking on dirt floors, but it was like, you know, we were spending money and living well for a short period of time. I'm talking a month. And then, you know, it's like we have cable TV, now we don't. We have cell phones, now we have to get new numbers because parents couldn't pay the bill, and a lack of stability. And so the root of I started placing my happiness and my value and my ability to produce a better life. Mm-hmm. And so I made no margin for myself. I managed money in theory wisely, but I left no margin, or I spent money that I shouldn't have spent. Although technically looking at it, I could afford it, but it wasn't a wise thing to do. You know, when I bought my new truck, yeah, I needed a truck. I owned a business and I needed something newer, nicer to pull a trailer with and to operate out of. But I could have gotten a work truck, right? But instead I had heated and cooled seats, heated steering wheel. And so what happened is this, I don't know if I'm careful with the word trauma because it's a little overused, I would say. But those life experiences that I made decisions on made me make decisions that seemed okay, but again, didn't leave me margin for error, didn't leave me margin for a really rainy day. And frankly, it was all fear-based, and so I was also not generous. I wasn't tithing. I wasn't doing a lot of the right things. And so it was the root. It wasn't that I had a poor goal. It's that I was so hungry and had this innate, like an unhealthy drive. I would say a demonic drive of you've got to have this and this and this, and you've got to do it by this certain time, you know, also looping in comparison. And so just the root was unhealthy. It's not that having a nice truck was unhealthy. It's that I felt like I had to have a nice truck and I had to have it sooner. Because there was that fear of loss where if I don't do it now, I may not ever be in a chance to get it later.
Sure. I believe a lot in the term value processing. You won't find it in many scholarly psychology studies or anything, but I believe that we go through value processing between the ages of 8 and 12. And what that means is that however we're treated, however we're valued by our parents or our peers between the ages of 8 and 12 is how we perceive life. You know, if we are in this constant inconsistency, then if we're not inconsistent as adults, then it just doesn't seem like we're doing life right. And so in a lot of ways, it sounds like that's kind of where you sat, that you had these high expectations, but if it was famine, it was like, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. There wasn't margin, as you put it, for the low points, your process was to make the highs as high as they could be and, you know, hope for the best and have the best, but know the worst is coming.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was that. Definitely in that 8 to 12 range was probably the, dare I say, some of the most chaotic times for our family. I grew up never seeing margin. We spent money when we had it. It was never, hey, you know, typically there's this much that we, you know, my parents maybe. So my dad also worked a fairly inconsistent job. And so what that meant is, you know, he might do really, he did really well when he worked, but depending on what he was, you know, his travel and things like that, he might work 8 months out of the year. He might work 10. He might work 3. And so you would think that would be the ideal job. It's like, we have to have margin. We have to plan for those tough years. We have to plan for those, you know, months when he's off. And, you know, I can't speak totally to my parents' finances, but it just never felt that way. Mm-hmm. It felt like it was, dare I say the word, poverty. And then, oh, dad's back at work again. Now we can eat out again more. Or now, you know, now we do this or this or this. And we always have just enough. And then, you know, he gets laid off again and we're back to where we were.
Right.
It never felt like they were like, hey, we know we need, here's our budget for the year. Regardless of how much he brings in this moment, this is what we're going to build, because we're going to build some consistency.
Right. And I think a lot of times parents fall into that trap of, well, we need to go out, we need to spend this money because our children may look at us differently because we didn't have anything and they felt like they weren't taken care of. And now we're going to treat them or to give them this big surprise. And what ends up happening is that the highs are highs, but the lows become even lower as life goes on.
Sure.
So how does that translate into your life today? I know, and not trying to bring another subject into this, but
I'm an open book.
But you and I talked to some length about hustle culture, and I believe that what you're talking about leads you into believing that that's the way of life, to be a hustler. So you want to speak to that just a little bit?
Yeah, hustle culture brings death. To be short, here's the thing: I think a lot of people, even Christians, would hear that and say that that's ridiculous. It's not ridiculous, because what I'm not saying is, I'm not saying don't work hard. I'm not saying don't work harder than other people. I'm not even saying don't be competitive. What I'm saying is hustle culture says that I want to be careful with my words here. Hustle culture says you've got to work harder than everyone else, and that's directly tied to what you reap. Which there's some truth there. Hustle culture says you've got to hustle so that you can have more, so that you can from there have more and more and more and more and more. But what's the point? Mm-hmm. Hustle culture says you've always got to be productive. You've always got to be busy. You've always got to be super regimented. And here's it. All those things are true. But to what end? So what it had me going into was, I've got to hustle. Like, it had me even trying to externally justify why I wanted the money, when in reality it was pure selfish ambition, because I didn't have any. I said I wanted to be generous, and I did, but I wanted to have a nice house first. Mm-hmm. It said that I wanted to have a lot of employees, and it did, but I also needed a lot of employees to get to the goals I wanted to. That's not what we're called to do. I believe that the word, the Bible, is truth, because it is Jesus, and Jesus is truth. And I believe it's backwards. Even in hustle culture, they're starting to figure it out. You've got to be generous first. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is, you know, value-based selling is what they'll call it. But, you know, ultimately, I'll just tell you, as someone who did this, you know, I've worked till 2 and then got up at 4. And worked out and sold all day and made 250 calls a day. And I've done all the things. I've read all the books. It will not fulfill you. Not only will it not fulfill you, but it a lot of times won't even, without the right base, it just won't get you where you think it's going to get you. Mm-hmm. Or even if it does. So for me, I did okay financially, but I never got to where I wanted. But there might even be other people that are better and in some ways wiser. Maybe that be financially, maybe that be with whatever, and they'll financially get better, but everything else in their life will fall away and break. Ultimately, it's got to be, you've got to detach your identity from the outcome of the hustle culture. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was at. My entire identity was wrapped up in, I'm a business owner, and I came from a fairly poor family, and now I'm going to make something of myself, which is why I started buying things I couldn't afford and doing things I couldn't afford to do, because it was my identity. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, Like, for example, we've made a decision. We'll never go into debt for a vehicle ever again, period. And the reason why is because I don't mind driving something. I would rather drive an old 4Runner or an old Chevrolet truck that I've maintained really well. And I don't have that fear of that $700 payment coming up. Not to mention, that's just not as wise, but my identity is not attached to how nice of a truck I drive. Mm-hmm. My identity is attached to, I'd rather be silent and not flashy and not in your face, but extremely, not only just financially stable, but generous. I'd rather, you know, go do cool works for people or be generous to my friends when they need it or even strangers when they need it and be open to the Holy Spirit saying, hey, this person needs money. You don't know him. Go give him this amount. Mm-hmm. And be able to do that and be cheerful and happy and excited about it and not worried way more than I would ever want to, you know, be worried about. Do I have the new truck that came out this year, or do I have the new iPhone or whatever? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I think that the two dangers that fall in there is that one, that hustle culture leads to quality of life issues. You're not spending time with your family. You're not spending time doing the things you enjoy. You're not getting out and doing the things that you need to do for yourself. I saw this meme the other day, and it was pretty hilarious. I may have sent it to you. And it said, don't be mad at me for not giving you the time that you feel like you need, because I don't give myself the time that I need, and I'm with myself 24 hours a day. And that's kind of the way that we live, and that we don't give ourselves that time. But it's because we've wrapped ourselves up in this identity of who we think we're supposed to be. And so then the second trap comes into that, and we use this big word, until. I won't feel successful until, or I can't wait until. And the problem with that is while we do need to have goals and we do need to have these things that we're looking forward to, we can fall in this trap of that until, when you get there, is meaningless.
It's a carrot. It's a moving carrot that will always change. There'll always be the next thing. And yeah, people, you hear this sort of falsehood talking about, like, most rich people are miserable. And I don't think that's necessarily true. But when their identity is wrapped up in achieving a goal in the next thing, not in making the most of where they're at in this situation, yeah, like, you get to a point where you've either, there's nowhere else to go, maybe because of your age, or you've just done it all. Hmm. I mean, look at Elon Musk. Like, he is constantly trying to do something else because he's constantly trying to achieve the next goal. Now, I'm not saying he's miserable, he's unhappy, but he's in that place where he's so young and he's achieved what he wants, but the mission behind it seems to, I don't know, I don't want to get off track, but yeah, I mean, if your identity and joy and happiness and satisfaction is wrapped up in the next thing, the next level, the next step of the ladder, that goes on forever. Mm-hmm. And eventually you'll say, well, what's next? Nothing. And then your entire life crumbles. That's why you see people grow a company and then they sell it young, and they have, you know, they sell a company for $500 million and they try to quote unquote retire, and they think the beaches and the Mai Tais and all that stuff is cool, and it's cool for 6 months, and they're like, I have no purpose, I'm just floating, drinking, miserable. Mm-hmm. And that's where people talk about the suicides and the just unhappiness and bitterness and
Well, a lot of times we can, the best example of this is people who have made a career in the military, and then all of a sudden they're discharged, that value that they once have, they don't have anymore, and they're not ever going to get it again. And so now all of a sudden their identity that was their value is completely gone. There's a reason that we see that more Fortune 500 CEOs are committing suicide than other lower income based corporations. That's because they've worked themselves into this identity. And at one point, you're going to have that moment of where you realized you have spent a majority of your life with your identity being something that you're completely not.
Yep.
That you're wrapped up in this this persona or this pose, as we call it, of being somebody that you're not. And so the result of all of that is depression, anxiety, fear, nervousness. And so then that leads into a mental health condition. And you know, you're a big proponent of mental health issues, I know. And so at what point do we say, okay, and this is where Christian counseling really gets crossways between Christian counseling and traditional counseling psychology, is that at what point does it become from a spiritual nature into a mental health issue? And I think that it crosses paths when that identity all of a sudden causes there to be physical changes, whether it's you have a low mood, a depressed mood, where you have uncontrollable crying, you're not able to sleep, you sleep too much. And so when that physical manifestation starts taking place, it moves from the spiritual into the physical. And so then one of the biggest lies we've ever been told is that if you're depressed or you're sad or you're angry or whatever the mental health manifestation may be, is simply you don't trust God enough. And I'm sure you've probably heard that. If you would just trust God more, if you would just give more, if you would just read your Bible more, that all of this would go away. And that's simply not true.
Well, so here's the trap. Let me break this down a little bit more. So the trap that I initially fell into is I'm leaning on myself, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm constantly trying to, okay, we're financially short. What can I hustle up? What can I sell? What promotion can I run? Whatever, like I've got to make this happen. That's what you just described is the secular version of the same thing. It's the religious version, because it's still about what you can do. Mm-hmm. It's still about how can you're trying to manipulate God, and God's not a dial. God's not a machine that you flip a switch on. So it's not, I'm just going to go pray more, or I'm just going to, okay, maybe it's because I haven't tithed as much. I'm going to make that tithe and God's going to bless me. Like, NF has a song called Mansions, and it essentially talks about like these hidden rooms, these hidden dark rooms in your soul. And here's the thing. If you're truly in a relationship with Christ, like he's going to flesh those out. Mm-hmm. He's going to find them. You're not going to hide. God says, I don't want 99.98% of you. I want 100% of you. Mm-hmm. And so I'll just say this, and I'm not a professional, but I think you would agree, specifically from a spiritual issue, anything that requires you to do more mm-hmm. is wrong. Mm-hmm. Anything that says, now I'm not saying that there's, so you mentioned, when does it cross over from a spiritual issue into a physical issue? Well, I mean, really, I think that's the world we live in anyways. Everything is controlled spiritually. Mm-hmm. We get a manifestation physically. So it's constantly crossing over. I think there are some like palpable like things you can do, right? There are some things that you can do now that will help, that will just serve as maybe even ways to reorient yourself or reorient your thinking, or maybe serve as that physical stoppage to say, hey, I'm going back into this. This is how I recognize that trigger and turn back around. But you still got to put your eyes back on Jesus, because mm-hmm. that's the root.
Right.
You know, Jesus said while he was here, I'm the vine, my Father's the vine dresser, and you're the limb, or you're the branch. You can't produce any fruit on the branch without the vine. And so if you're not resting and abiding in him, I would personally say that I don't think it's going to matter what counseling you take, what medicine you take, what self-help, yoga, chakra, it's not going to matter. And if you're not focused on the vine, the root of life, you will never bear fruit.
Yeah. And in traditional fashion, I somewhat agree with which one.
And, it's a joke between Brian and I, and I get that a lot.
Yeah, I somewhat agree with you. I really, so in counseling, I deal with two types of people. One type of person is the one that they have drove their identity so much that they need to turn loose of some things. And the other is that they've drove their self so deep that they need to get some things. But both of those result in their identity being in Christ and not of themselves. Now, the most effective form of psychotherapy is counseling with medication, but the medication helps you to get through the counseling because therapy in and of itself is traumatic. And so you get through these states of trauma in order to come out on the other side. And if you look at any type of recovery group, whether it be NA or AA or whatever, the very first premise is that you believe in a higher power, something that's bigger than yourself. And whether that's somebody who is a Christian that believes that that higher power is God, or whether that's a non-Christian who believes their higher power is whatever it is, there must be a belief that is outside of you and outside of your control. Even in Scripture, we see where these great leaders who were fixers, if you will, I think about Moses, there's fixers, and now they're here, and they're in front of the sea, and what are we going to do? Well, what does the Lord tell him? Be still. Be still. And so many times we are running so rampant, whether it's that we have this hyper intensity, I've got to make it work, or whether we are so depressed that we don't know where to turn. It's in those moments that we're just to be still, just to take a step back and to realize that God is in control. Now, you telling me that God is in control is going to do as much good as me telling you to just calm down. So there has to be that aspect of let's look at the big picture and not just right here and now.
Yeah. And I want to clarify what I said because, you know, I don't want anyone hearing this to hear me say medicine can't be a tool. I want to be careful with traditional, but, you know, true therapy can't be a tool. These are tools. Mm-hmm. They're just not the end-all be-all.
Sure.
They're the tools to get us back, right? I mean, the Bible talks about, you know, tilling up your fallow ground, giving a reference to farming. But the thing is like you still need a tool to do all that.
Sure.
So I don't think like, you know, if my daughter gets injured, if she goes out and she cuts her leg really bad, severs an artery, I'm not just only going to be still and start praying. I'm going to use what God's given me.
Sure.
I'm going to tourniquet her leg. We're going to get her to a hospital. But that's not the ultimate source of healing long term for us.
Sure.
Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah,
that.
And there are those that go through the depression, anxiety issues that are reliant upon medication and are completely against therapy. And medication doesn't get to the root of the problem. It just suppresses the problem for a while. And so I believe that, and I actually wish it was law that if you were being prescribed some kind of antidepressants. Now, there are other things like, you know, schizoaffective disorder that has to be treated with medication. But we're talking very entry-level depression, anxiety kind
depression
of things.
That starts with the root of identity, not with a physical illness.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in those things that the medication is used in concert with therapy of finding out, you know, what am I trying to do here that I ultimately need to let God do in my life?
Here's the simple way of thinking of it, right? So we're in Arkansas. I grew up in a farming community. So a lot of the agricultural stuff actually makes a lot of sense. And in Arkansas, it's actually our state fruit is a tomato. Mm-hmm. Everyone grows tomatoes. Well, the Bible says that the word is living water, right? And that's what we water our soil with, if you think of the parable of the seed and the sower. Well, in Arkansas, generally speaking, when you see tomato plants, when they get bigger, they use I don't even know what they're called, but it's basically a tool to help hold the branches up so that it can produce more fruit. Well, that's a tool. So that doesn't mean that that tool's wrong, but you can't only use that tool and not water it. So it's a tool. Medicine's a tool. Therapy's a tool. They're okay. You just can't only use the tools and not give it water or food.
Sure.
So,
Yeah. Which then leads into that higher power.
That's all. Yeah. That's right.
In my opinion, that's the only way to truly be healed, is in that area. Now, again, with, and I hate to use the word true mental illness, but let's talk about, let's put this in the category of incurable mental illness. Bipolar is not curable. It's a brain chemical condition. Schizoaffective disorder is not curable. Of course, God can heal anything he wants to heal because he's sovereign. But in those issues, they will have to have lifelong medication as a tool to help them to live a seemingly what we would define as a normal life, whatever that looks like. But it has to be used with them being completely reliant upon God to carry them through. But yeah, I do like what you said about using it as a tool and not a crutch. You know, it's a lot of times that's where it ends up being.
Say that, because I don't know how biblically accurate this is. I think it is, but it was easy. We watched The Chosen as a family. That's kind of our one of our contents we watch. And little James, one of the disciples, actually has an issue with his leg. Mm-hmm. And at least at first, Jesus says he's not going to heal him. And he tells him that, like, you're not going to get healed from this. So we know that for whatever purpose and plans, there are certain true physical manifestation afflictions that God sovereignly might choose to not heal. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that James hops around and doesn't use a crutch to walk.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it would be foolish for us to say, or maybe even teetering on being extreme, if we didn't use the tools that's provided for us. Again, they just can't be the end. They've got to be the tool. They can't be the bread or the water.
Yeah. So trying to wrap all this up in a pretty bow, if you could, your message to the world or anybody listening today, what would your message be to them?
Jesus. That's it. Man does not live by bread alone. So I think it's so funny. It's funny how some of the cultural terms actually almost supernaturally go back, because you hear, I got to go get this bread. I got to go make this money. But that's the same way Satan tempted Jesus. And Jesus, what did he answer? He quoted the Old Testament, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word breathed by the living God. If you're listening to this, I'm assuming maybe you're a Christian, maybe you're not. What I would tell you is no amount of hustle, work, all that leads to death if it's not rooted in the Word, because the Word is truth. Mm-hmm. The best mathematician in the world can't get the math right if you don't give him the right information. And so if you're making decisions with the wrong info, you might be making what seem like sound decisions, but it's based on bad data, and you'll never get where you want to go. And it's just going to lead to a life of destruction. And so that doesn't mean that you can't. Speaking on hustle culture, this is a very financial thing for me, is how it manifested. It doesn't mean you can't have nice things. Matter of fact, I believe that some of us are meant to go on missions, and some of us are meant to fund missions, mm-hmm. or both. So winning financially is not inherently wrong. But if you say, I love Jesus and I'm a Christian, and you're going to try to walk that walk, I'm just going to tell you, God's going to go through and deal with your heart, and your heart's got to be, it's got to be there for the right reasons. And if your identity as the bride of Christ is anything other than Christ, he's going to flesh it out one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And you need to know that.
Yeah, that's good. Tyler, thank you for being here with us today and sharing a little bit of your story. Of course, I'm Doc Brian. You can find all of my social media content at thedocbrian.com. Again, we're in LifeWord Studios today. You can find all of their streaming content at lifeword.org. Thank you for being here with us today. Again, Tyler, thank you for being our guest. And we will talk to you soon. Goodbye.